When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 122. I'm your host Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading east to Cambridgeshire to talk to a farmer and chair of the Nature Friendly Farming Network, Martin Lines. Martin, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Good evening.
Good evening. And how are your crops looking over in Cambridgeshire? Because as we all know, we've had a lot of heavy rain in the UK lately.
Yeah, most of them are looking pretty good. We're desperate for some rain. It's just as normally does. It comes in big lumps, but hopefully we can get over it. We see other people have got far more than we had, and I'm grateful we didn't have that.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us a bit about South Cambridgeshire, where you live. What's unique about it, especially for people who might not be from the UK?
It's quite a flat area. It's a very arable area with a lot of built up. Cambridge City and Peterborough and built-up areas. And there's a variety of different soils. So we have, one end of the county, you've got the chalks, the other end, the sands, slightly north, you've got the clays, and then, of course, we've got the fenland and the highly productive areas around there.
Yeah, okay. So you would have a range of different soil types across your farms as well?
Most of ours is clay based. We have a few bit of silt here, but it's mainly sort of chalky boulder clay, so it gets quite sticky quite easily.
Yeah, okay. So how long have your family been farming there?
So my grandfather came here in 1936. His father had bought the farm at the time as 303 acres, and it was quite dilapidated from what he used to tell us. It had been almost abandoned for a number of years. And he sort of put it, rebuilt it, cleaned the fields up, and grew it a little bit. Sort of the family farm now is sort of 415 acres, 165 hectares. And sort of my father got involved in the business, and then sort of I've got involved as well.
Okay, so were you always going to get into the business? Were you always going to be a farmer, or were you ever interested in doing something else?
I've always had a lot of interest in it. I've always enjoyed getting out in the countryside, working with my father, working on the farm, always fun jobs to do. I've got an older brother. He wasn't so interested in it. He liked the mechanic side of things. So it was quite good. I used to break things and he was there to fix it. It made it quite good. And because he wanted the mechanic side, it sort of made some space for me to sort of take on the farming side.
Yeah, okay. So I know you were very involved with the Young Farmers Club and you've carried on with other community groups. Is that something that you are quite passionate about?
Yeah, very. I strongly believe we should all take our part in helping our communities and helping others. So we are heavily involved in Young Farmers back in the day. Thoroughly enjoyed that. Did club chairman. We, at the time, amalgamated what was the Isle of Ely County and the West Anglia, two counties together before to bring together to make Cambridgeshire Young Farmers. And I was the second chair of that. Had a great time and managed to travel about a bit with Young Farmers. Also went over to Russia with Young Farmers and Estonia on a study tour. And that sort of opened my eyes to sort of other farming methods and and just that fellowship of meeting like-minded people and sort of have a crack. So you used to go to the conferences and you didn't need to know many people, but you can have a lot of fun with, friends you haven't met before.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then sort of when I finished or got towards the end of my Young Farmers times, we revitalized the county show and moved it to a Sunday. And myself and my family, my wife and my mum and brother. We sort of set that up from a traditional young farmers rally on a Saturday that used to be held by different clubs every year. No club wanted to hold it. And I said, well, let's go for it. But it's going to have to be on a Sunday because actually we need to get the public to come and see what young farmers are doing. And if we want to raise some money, it's the public we need to engage with and take the pound out of their pocket, really, to support young farmers. And it was, how do we sell what young people are doing in the countryside? So actually they celebrated the 20th year a few weeks ago. So they've seen that sort of really go. I'm also quite involved. I'm a parish councillor. I've been a school governor for over 10 years. I've just stood down from that because time is quite, you know, spare time is very short. I'm involved with my local church and other community groups. And it's just this, put, if we have some spare time, put something back in your community.
We're going to take a short ad break now to talk about agricultural weighing specialist Griffith Elder. Griffith Elder specialise in agriculture with their weighing equipment. They design, manufacture here in the UK and supply weighbridges, portable weigh beams, multi-axle weighbridges and a host of other weighing equipment for weighing on the farm. The scales are a great way to know how much you've taken from the field and keep track what you have coming in and going out. The portable weigh beams are incredibly easy to install, so no need for any groundworks, and can be placed straight in the yard or moved from store to store as and when you need. All of their scales come with an extensive range of recording equipment options and farm management software, and one very popular piece of kit is their cab fob system, which enables the driver to record the weight of their load without having to leave the comfort of the cab. Built to last for decades, Griffith Elder pride themselves in making simple to install, easy to operate and proven longevity weighing equipment for all their products.
Yeah. And do you think that's something that's quite important for farmers to do as well, to sort of get out of the farming bubble and connect with other members of the community, not just farmers?
Yeah, I think it's really important because it's, you become, as you say, you're in a bubble. And sometimes even on those bad times, you know, when everything's wrong and the weather's not right or the business isn't going well, you're only talking to other people in that grumpy mindset. And it's not good for you at all. So after I finished Young Farmers, I moved on to Round Table. And that was a similar sort of club of like-minded people from different parts of different industries. So actually you could go out and sit and have a moan about business. And somebody in construction or in heavy haulage or engineering would say, well, farming is not that much different to what we're doing. And you start to understand that, you know, farming's a business. Many other businesses have troubles. And so we're not quite so unique in our problems.
Absolutely. Okay, so what kind of crops are you growing on the farm?
So at the moment we're spring barley, winter wheat, beans, a little bit of oilseed rape. And one of the farms we contract on, we've tried growing some millet this year.
Oh, how's that going? That must be interesting.
Yeah, it's for a Bertie contract. It went in the dry and it's got rather wet now, so it's just coming through. But that's sort of quite exciting.
Yeah.
We've gone from a rotation a few years ago where we're mainly wheat and rape and getting really challenged with blackgrass and various things. We've really opened up the rotation and use our rotation for weed control, really, and do a lot more spring cropping. And it's sort of now looking at what else crops can we grow, because the more diverse I can make our rotations, the better the system will become.
And there's a bit of history to the farm, isn't it? It's quite an old steading, isn't it?
So we've got some old barns that used to have the steam engines in. There's some old stablings. We've got a medieval moated site. There was a house here in 1100 recorded, and in 1386 there was three nuns here who left here to start Hinchinbrook Monastery, which is now Hinchinbrook House, where Oliver Cromwell lived. We know the Romans were here. There's some areas where we think there was a settlement. There's lots of sort of pottery and artifacts, coins we find. And for me, it's just to have, we're only here for, as me, as farming, it's such a small bit. And when I think when the Romans were here, all the features in our landscape, they saw none of that, because none of the trees, nothing of those features were there. The topography was there, but not what I see.
Yeah.
And just how much change has happened over those generations of sort of, and how much change can we hopefully deliver positive to it as well?
Yeah. Well, we found various Roman coins and bits and bobs here as well. And it is, I'm glad you said that really, because it's quite interesting. It does make you feel like you're, when you know that the landscape of your farm's been farmed for thousands of years, it does kind of make you feel like just part of something, doesn't it, I think?
Yeah, it's when you find something, a piece of metalwork, a coin or something,
yeah.
and you just think somebody else was here, what were they doing?
Yeah.
You know, how were they farming? And it just makes me feel quite special to this landscape, to this farm.
Yeah.
And sort of just being part of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Part of the journey.
Yeah, yeah. What kind of changes has the farm seen over the years, particularly in the last few generations?
So my grandfather and my father sort of grew the farm, grew the size of the fields. Post-war, they're incentivized to fill ditches in, took out most of the hedgerows, and sort of focus on production. And, you know, everyone was hungry.
Yeah.
The concern was to feed everyone, and little regard to the features that they removed.
Mm-hmm.
That they were just seen as obstacles. And then when I came back into after school and went off to college, came back into the business and got involved, and it was like a lot of the rules and regulations were saying we shouldn't spray or treat near the outside of a field, near a water course. So as the person had to do the spraying, it was like it'd be a lot easier if we had a buffer zone there. I wouldn't have to worry about all the rules and regulations and tick all the boxes and check which chemical I used.
Mm-hmm.
We also had a lot of problems with hair courses. So a lot of evenings and weekends, people used to come out and drive across or run across the fields chasing hares and other livestock. So it was like I was trying to convince my father that to actually put some of those less productive areas around the outside into margins and put some hedges back, it would be a good idea. It took a little bit of convincing. but actually, eventually allowed me to go into a scheme that we did that, and he sort of giggled that he was paid to take the hedgerows out and it bust his back doing that.
Yeah.
And then we were spending the winters planting the things again and buggering ourselves up. But actually, we put them back in the landscape where they fitted hopefully a modern farming system, and actually made our fields more secure and sort of hid our fields and some of the wildlife that was in there.
Yes.
And as we've made those changes, it sort of really did make him struggle, because he wanted to see the hedges cut every season. And I'm like, no, we'll cut them every 2 or 3 years. There's no need for that. It's an additional cost. And the wildlife benefits to doing that really became apparent. So when that scheme finished, we went into another one. And that really was when he was really challenged with it, because I was saying, well, we'll square the fields up. Why are we farming these corners or around that pole? We'll do some straight lines. And it wasn't until we actually saw it on the ground, he was saying, well, you took out, 20, 30 acres. And I'm like, yeah, but they were awkward bits. We can't get our modern machinery in there. And then we showed him the figures of why we're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't always believe the paperwork, the figures. But it was a sort of a real benefit to the business. I mean, his mindset that we've got to farm it all.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, well, actually, I'm not going near those edges. And why do I need to keep things trim and tidy? It costs me money. It makes another job for us, particularly at harvest time. I do it in the winter. So he'd gone from a farm that he, worked to the very edges. And as soon as harvest was over, everything got trimmed,
mm-hmm.
to a farm that, well, in his eyes, looked quite scruffy around the outside. So he always held the checkbook, and all his life he'd been in control until, unfortunately, he passed away last year. But he held the control of the business, and it was always a challenge trying to move things along and to sort of make him see what I was seeing and why I wanted to do it. It's the same as we used to plough many years ago, and I was setting somebody up ploughing. And when we turned the soil over and I was running alongside the plough setting it up, I saw the tread print of the previous year's ploughing in the bottom of the furrow. And I'm like, hang on, why is this field getting so wet? When, you know, in my head, we're getting wetter because we're squashing the ground more. We're getting bigger and bigger tractors, filling them up with the tires up with water, running in the bottom of a furrow where we ploughed it and we run the tractor in that open slot, moving our weights and our compaction down. So we were buying bigger and bigger bits of machinery to move more soil. And I said, hang on, Father, we've got to change this. And I convinced him to let me plough on top with an old crawler plough, which he said, well, we never managed to pull it, and we did. So that improved our soil a little bit.
Yeah.
And then we moved on to, said, well, why are we ploughing? What's the point? When we can, some of the newer machinery of like disc and tying cultivators in a carriage that, you know, did all of it in one go.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved into that kind of machine and a bigger tractor to pull that. And then he said, well, the first year we had that, I cultivated the field as we planned to, parked the machine up in the yard. Unfortunately, he lived sort of at the end of the drive and he could look up into the yard and saw this tractor that we'd just spent an awful lot of money on the machine, sat in the yard. I went down to see him and he blew his lid at me again. Said, you know, what's he doing stood there? You've spent all this money, it's got to work.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I've done the job. You know, we budgeted it out, it was saving us money. I've done the job it wanted to do. Well, we're going to park up for a week or two, let the weeds germinate while we're doing some other jobs. And he was like, no, it's got to work. You can't have tractors stood in the yard. So off I went to cultivate another field just because he decided it couldn't sit in the yard. So at the end of the week, I sent him an invoice for the cost of doing that job, which he wasn't over amused at. But I think I got my point across that actually a tractor running in a field costs us money.
Yeah.
If we've done the job, it doesn't. So he sort of eased up a little bit on me.
Mm.
But it was, he always struggled, you know, allowing me to change things. Most changes were, in my eyes, a 3-year process.
Yeah.
The first year is an argument and highlight what other people are doing. The second year, he's softening. By the third year, it was his idea. And why haven't you changed anything?
I think there'll be a lot of people listening who work with their dads who would be, will sound familiar.
Yeah. I mean, I really, really enjoyed working in most of the time.
Yeah.
It was really hard work a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But that he was, you know, one of the small regrets I've always had is I've never had much time away from the farm.
Mm.
It was always, we're too busy or you can't do that. Or he always, you know,
yeah.
Just, I didn't get the opportunities I could have done.
Mm-hmm.
And I was offered, and it's sort of, I look back, and you just think it's one of the regrets, but I've, you know, thoroughly enjoyed working with him.
Yeah.
And he's left his mark on the farm, and sort of, I have my opportunity now to do my small piece.
Yeah. Okay. So had you always been interested in nature and the environment growing up? Was there anything that sort of, was it like a catalyst moment? Was there something that you thought, well, I need to do things differently with the farm?
I think it's when I come back from, as a young lad, used to knock about the farm at weekends and evenings and any time I could get out of school. You see a lot of wildlife here. We were encouraged to keep the sparrows out of grain stores and deter them of being about. And then sort of, as I come back from college and got involved with the business, and Father used to say, oh, the grey partridge used to be on this hillside. There always used to be lots of them. I didn't see many of them.
Mm.
And there's many other things you just didn't notice. And then after we started doing some of the stewardship work and just putting some margins about and putting some hedgerows back, suddenly, you know, more of that wildlife was about. And it just opened my eyes again. And then we had some people come round to do a bird survey, a volunteer, and he got excited about seeing a hobby and some other species that I saw every day. I didn't. They were just big brown birds and little brown birds.
Mm.
And when people got excited about seeing something that I saw every day and took for granted, it sort of actually sort of, wow, we're actually custodians of not just the land, but the habitat and the wildlife here.
Mm.
And the more over the journey sort of grown over the last 20 years, of the more I understand it, the more I try and work with it, and particularly the last sort of 4 or 5 years about the rest of the small stuff that we never see and, or never used to see. Now I stop and take notice. You know, those bugs on your machinery, those birds, those creepy crawlies. Last summer it was about butterflies walking through the meadows margins, and just sharing those pictures and those experiences, and people feeding back of, wow, I haven't seen one of those before, or this species, that species. And the more I farm with it and connect into the business and think about the pollinators, all the other things other than just my farming crops, the better the farming systems become, and the more I actually enjoy the farming. It's growing wheat is quite a simple operation. We know what we've got to do. We know roughly how we've got to look after it, and we hope to get a yield at the other end. But to add a bit more interest into the system, it's okay, so what else can we do, or can we change, or what else is growing or is in that field?
I know you've mentioned some examples there, but what are some more species that you're seeing more of around the farm?
I think one of the main ones I get most pleasure from is my barn owls. We used to see a few about, so we put some barn owl boxes up, and within the first year we had a family in there, so I actually got to get someone in to come and help me get them out, or they got them out to do some ringing. So we actually put a whole range of boxes up, of six other barn owl boxes and little owl boxes, starlings, sparrows, blue tits, grey tits, and a whole load of other things. So you can actually get connected with, and hopefully, you know, put some rings on those and sort of see them flying about around the neighbourhood. We also put a whole load of other features across the landscape. We put more, you know, cleaned up and freshened up the ponds and created new ponds. We put about 150 skylark plots in our winter cereals. So we, as we're drilling, we just stop the drill, move forward a few metres, and leave a bare area. Our beetle banks, birdseed mixes, because we've had the farm surveyed, we know what species we've got here or what we should have more of. So I can deliver different species of birdseed areas that aren't due for harvest. They were just there to feed birds through the winter. So a whole range of things right across the farm, and actually seeing just the vibrancy of the wildlife increase. And of course, you know, during the winter when we're doing supplementary feeding, so I'm out there feeding, you know, the sweepings out the barn, and also we buy in some seed mix to walk along a hedgerow and see, well, 3, 4, 5, maybe 1,000 birds, little birds rolling along that hedgerow as you're spinning out or throwing out the seed mixes. It's just, I think it's just wonderful to see.
Yeah. And I suppose those things you've mentioned there, they're pretty easy things. We can all do that on our farms, can't we, really?
Yeah. It's one thing I struggle with sometimes, because they are so easy. Not cutting hedges quite so often. Some hedges, yes, they need managing more, but others they don't. Why do everyone need to trim the edge of the fields off, or those awkward corners? And throughout the UK, there are some really quite good schemes to get into that actually, if you do them right, although there's a whole load of paperwork and trouble with the government's paying and all that side, but the actual schemes really can help your farming and your business and make your landscape work for wildlife and for farming. And it's one of the things that sort of geez me on to sort of engage other people. As much as the schemes are not great, particularly what's maybe coming in the future with a different payment structure and emphasis on what we need to deliver on our landscapes.
So have you got any big plans for improving habitat over the coming years on the farm? Is there any sort of changes that you've got on the horizon that you want to make?
Yeah, it's quite a lot. because a lot of the rules of, you know, there are 5 or 10 year prescriptions, yeah. And you know, and then you see things come along, you think, well, why can't I do that? So on one of the farms we contract on, we're doing strips every fourth tram line of flower margin, flower mix, okay, to increase pollinators. And I'm looking at some of our bigger fields with the GPS systems we run. Why can't we fit, you know, instead of like beetle banks and you know, could be trees up the rows. But if we can put pollinators up, I know that where we have increased pollinating margins, I'll see a yield increase, yeah, in my winter beans and my oilseed rape. We've also seen that there's more predatory insects, whether they're eating my slugs, slug eggs, or eating the aphids. So the more we have those in my on the farm, the less products I have to use. So I've actually, for the last 4 years, we haven't used insecticides on the farm because we have enough other things, creeper crawlies,
wow,
that eat all the bad ones. We still have some aphids. We still have some problems. But actually, if you're just a little bit of patience, there's enough good guys come and deal with them. And we haven't ever seen a yield loss. All I know is we've saved money. But the less I'm doing with products and thinking about the whole sort of wildlife ecosystem kind of thing, you build it into your farming system. So I'm thinking about the rotations and what problems may come by growing a crop before I grow it, and situating options around. So I can see my farm being, I want the fields to be squarer. So all those awkward bends, which we've taken a lot out already,
yeah,
but fit everything to my tramline system. And then I can put also features within the field, using sort of GPS, so they can stay there out of my way, but also increase habitat on the farm, because the more habitat I have, I'm finding the better the farming system is and the more resilient the farming system's becoming. And it's just fitting that in. And certainly when we look forward, you know, we've got a lot about climate change, increased trees, species decline and insect decline. Actually, we can do so much more with our landscape.
Mm.
And we have modern ways to actually fit it into a productive landscape. And we have room for, you know, we've all got corners or margins or bits. I see people trying to work around a pylon or a pole or a tree in a field, and they'll spend 10 minutes squeezing around this tree with their sprayer or their fertilizer spreader. And you just think, if you added that up every single time you do that operation, every single year, you're losing money. Mm. Draw a line around it and just make it simple for you.
Mm.
I mean, most machinery has got bigger now,
yeah,
and actually a lot of our fields and landscape were not designed for that. So on here, we've moved a lot of our field gateways. Instead of in the corners, we've moved them out to the tram line. So they've come out to 15 metres mark, filled the old one in, the gap in the hedge, so we can go from field to field, from the tram line to the tram line, so the corners don't get trodden in so often, because the old system was for small machineries, a horse and cart. And it's just looking at how we make our modern landscape work for farming, but also fit wildlife into it as well, because by heck, we do need to put some of it back, because we've been incentivized in the past to take lots of it out. And actually, as I find on my farm, the more we can put back in into sensible places, the better our farming system is becoming.
Yeah. As someone who's successfully running an arable farming business alongside all this environmental improvement, as you've outlined there, what do you say to farmers who doubt that the two can go in hand? Because you must hear people, I mean, there's always sort of doubting Thomases, isn't there? Who,
yeah.
You know, what do you say to them?
Come and see it. Yeah. Let me talk to you. I'll explain it. That it's not just me. There are farms across the whole of the UK,
yeah,
already doing this, already doing amazing things. And many of us have just done it quietly and sort of squeezed it in. And the focus is always, for me, all the press and media, it's always about the production we can deliver.
Mm.
And we also talk a lot about food security. For me, it's, if we don't have that healthy environment, healthy soils, how is the next generation going to have that productivity? And actually, if you think about it in a more integrated system and just think about all what you want to achieve off your farm, you can fit it all in and just be smart about it and fit it into a system that works for you. And as you go along the journey and it works better for you, you realize you want to do a lot more, because you realize the enjoyment of doing it, that actually cost savings in your business by taking those overlaps out, those awkward corners, those less productive areas, the rest of the farm is being more stable and producing more. So it's delivering a better gross margin. I'm very focused now on, you know, the areas of my fields. It's not a field, it's areas within the field, and it's a gross margin within those areas, because we've got parts of the fields, if I yield less than 8 ton a hectare, actually some of the schemes can reward me more than 8 tonne a hectare if I've got blackgrass problems. So why am I trying to farm it when I can, those awkward corners and wet areas, I can deliver other things? And when you start explaining that to other farmers and actually sit down with them and show them within their farm of what they could do, and actually the financial business benefit to their businesses, you see them just switch on and light up. We do have, there are lots of farmers out there that have, you know, they claim they have little regard for wildlife and it's just this fuzzy stuff around the outside and why should I bother? But actually, when you start talking about the cost savings and the benefits to your business, and actually it's not about what all these conservation groups want you to do, it's about having a healthier, better farm.
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah, there was always those out there that just won't get it straight away. I see farmers in three camps. You've got the third that are already doing lots and trying to do it within the system we're allowed to do it in, getting very frustrated with some of the rules and regulations and the tape measures that come out. You've got a third that are doing something and you know, do a little bit on the farm. And you've got the third that haven't done anything and don't know why they need to engage. They're there just to farm. And it's their farm. And it's sort of, if we move the two thirds forward, the other third will suddenly think, oh, I'm actually missing something out here. And sometimes they will move quicker than others because they suddenly wake up to how it can work.
Yeah. Is it, are attitudes changing, especially as a younger generation who might be more conscious of things like emissions and their effect on climate change come through? Are young people sort of more adaptable with this kind of thing, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for, you know, for generations, it's just focused about farming and getting as much production as you can. And everyone else is starting to think about, actually, what else can we deliver? I look at my landscape of what productivity can I get from this whole landscape? And what are the goods and services and all the other things I can deliver to make my business run well? Because I've got to be a profitable business to keep going. But also, what else can we fit in? And I think the younger people are also looking at different ways, different opportunities, and also connected with people outside of farming and realise that you've got huge amounts of public out there that want to hear and know about all the other things we do on our landscape. They know where the food, they don't even know where the food comes from, but they understand we produce food and we have livestock and we grow crops. But they're also very concerned about all the other things that yet they hear stories of, and you know, things we haven't got on the farms anymore, the wildlife, the insects, and most young people are really starting to wake up to that and sort of, how do we fit that into the business?
Okay. So with that then, tell us about the Nature Friendly Farming Network. How did it initially come about?
So about 5-6 years ago now. As a farmer who was delivering stewardship, entry-level and high-level stewardship schemes and supporting other farmers delivering that, I was taken to events, met some other farmers, being held up as sort of a case model of what some people are doing. You'd be sort of there at an event, all very great, meeting other farmers. Event was over, you went home, and that was it. You'd sort of had your piece. So I started raising the question to other organisations and to other farmers, well, where's our voice? You know, we hear so much about this is what's seemed to be a better way. We know it fits our businesses better. Where's our voice? And there's organisations that are out there that are very good regionally. There's nothing across the UK that actually championed farming where you connect and have wildlife and habitats at the core of our business. We are very vibrant, viable, productive farms, but we can have habitat and wildlife. And there's many farmers out there. So a survey was done probably 4 years ago, an independent survey across the UK with a group of farmers. And feedback, one of the main feedbacks was they didn't feel like they had a voice. They always felt they were not the right sort of farmers. The industry only talked about other things, not about as farmers, wildlife. We also have a whole range of conservation groups keep saying farming was not great and how bad farmers are. Well, actually, some of us, we were celebrated sometimes.
Yeah.
So where was the voice? So just over 2 years ago, I was asked to see if I wanted to help formulate a committee and a group, which I did, and pulled some different people from different organisations together and say, well, this is my vision. And we came up with a little plan. And then I started talking to different farmers across the UK that I'd met or I'd been given a contact details for. And then we held our first steering group meeting a year last November. And we put the plan out there. And everyone who came along said, yep, really, you know, really like the idea. Really like the concept of giving us a voice across the UK. We drew up a manifesto. Then we launched a year last January at the Real Oxford Farming Conference. And it just happened to be the same time as Michael Gove stood up and said about farming, wildlife, a new payment system. We got to deliver both. Mm-hmm. And almost everything he said was in our manifesto. And from that point on, it has just been a rocketing roller coaster ride. That's the only way I can describe it.
Yeah.
Because the network was set up for farmers to come together to champion and to celebrate what we can do, but also to engage with policy and sort of engage with politicians and other organizations to say, we can do better, we can do more of this. And if we get sensible policy, sensible arrangements, we can make a lot better work a lot more. And it's a fairer, for me, it's about a fairer way of public supporting farmers delivering good things on our landscape.
Mm.
So once we got it going, we suddenly realised that actually, me as an English farmer, I couldn't go to Scotland and talk about farming systems. And someone from Scotland couldn't go to Wales because it's different farming.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up with steering groups in England, Wales, Northern Ireland and Scotland. So we have our own set of steering group of farmers working with their policy people, working with the governments in each of those areas. And then the chair and the vice chair of those groups come together, and I'm ended up being the UK chair to sort of put the piece over the top and make sure it all connects and work. So then, yeah, a whole range of other organisations we've gone out to, a lot of the conservation organisations said, look, I went out to them and said, you know, you want to work with like-minded farmers? You keep sort of saying, you know, there's a better way. We are delivering a lot of what you're trying to do. We won't always see eye to eye. Will you support? And I was amazed and blown away by the amount of support they've offered us in just opportunities, opening doors, mm-hmm. Lending us rooms, whatever we needed, and sort of helped it grow. And then we've managed to secure funding for the next couple of years because it's free to join the network. We didn't want to put a membership fee to it because what are we offering at the beginning? And this is about a network of connecting different groups and different farmers and different voices to sort of have a middle ground. For many years, there's been the main part of farming industry over one side, the conservation groups on the other side,
yeah,
and nothing but arguments and squabbles at the top, you know, over top. But actually, the staff on the ground, most of them are quite sensible. And
yeah.
We got on, you know, most farmers got on with the butterfly conservation, the RSPB, the wildlife trust person on the ground.
Mm.
So we actually needed to build those links and find a middle way, find some common ground to have some debates. And that's what we've started to do and to sort of facilitate and sort of just champion a way of actually it does work, but here's are the obstacles. Here's, particularly with the policy and the government changes that are coming, here are some opportunities to make it really work for farming businesses.
Yeah, and it's open to all farmers, isn't it? So small farmers, organic, conventional,
yep.
and also yep. to the public as well. The public can join, can't
yep.
it? Isn't it? Why did you decide to go down that route? Is it just, I suppose, carrying on with the connections, linking the two, farmers and
yeah.
the public?
So we have a range of farmers. I think our smallest is less than an acre, but they've got 30 some odd people working on that acre. I mean, really productive, up to huge estates, 10, probably 15,000 acres estates. Conventional, organic, it's not about your farming system in whether you're an organic or conventional. It's about how you're combining it all
yeah.
and making a system work for you and your farm. But also, there's no point just farmers standing up and doing it. We see it so often. We talk in echo chambers. We stand up and complain as farmers, or champion ourselves as farmers, or do something. Are we right? You know, it's only to farmers. Well, that's not going to get us anywhere.
No.
So we, you know, the idea was to offer it to public as well, so they can come and join. They'll support. We can communicate to them. We can sort of ask them to campaign for us and with us. Like, we can ask them to be aware of the products and services they might want to buy in the future, particularly, you know, depending on what trade deals we end up with. We need to be able to communicate to the public in how we produce our food here and how we manage the landscape and the wildlife. Maybe remind them that to keep the dog on a lead when the lambs and the sheep are in the field, when they're walking the dog on an arable farm and letting the dog run all the way through the woods and the stewardship. It's ground nesting season. We just need to be very careful and proactive in how we engage with them, because they are our customers and they are people that have also given us their tax. For me, it's their tax money in supporting agriculture, and we need to give them an offer back and that engagement.
Now, one thing I was also interested to see was you run a lot of training and events for farmers. Do you get a good response?
Yeah, that's sort of one area of the network we're developing and growing. So the network's only been going a year and a half, and the first year was going out and working out what's already delivered out there, who's delivering what, can we connect. It's not about doing another course. It's, well, if that group and that group, or that wildlife group and that farmer group, join together with some staff on the ground, we can have a better event. And so the things we've been supporting and been engaging with is getting some really good feedback and really good engagement. A lot of those are already the farmers who would turn up to events. So that's sort of the easy engagement. Yeah. Once we know what our future is going to hold in new farming payment policies, and whether we're going to have what sort of elm we're going to have in England and in Wales, which kind of structure system it's going to be there, then we're very keen, and we're engaging with DEFRA and the different governments in the different devolved areas, how we can support that change, because a lot of that's about mindset change in the farmer, how it would work for him and why. And as farmers within the network, we're probably doing a lot of that already. So we're looking at building that development of engaging with different groups, with different farmers, and sort of lead on that, what could be done. So that's sort of a lot of work we're planning and developing over the next couple of years. We just need to know a little bit of direction of actually what they want us to deliver and the time frame that we've got to deliver as. In England, we're looking at probably a 7 to 9 year transition window. But how quick will those who can move, and how much help and support those who have not done anything like it, how much do they need, and what sort of support? Certainly farmer to farmer engagement and training is the best way forward. You always learn.
Yeah.
If I go to a meeting and hear another farmer talking, I'm always picking up more things than hearing some head of some organization stand there and tell me how I should be doing it.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't always go so well.
No, it doesn't. No, we've talked about sort of the government support schemes changing from direct payments, which we know are going to be phased out, in place of public money for public goods schemes. How confident are you that the government will get this right? Because one of the big problems for stewardship schemes, which has seen many farmers sadly stop participating, has been mismanagement at the government end, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, for my own farm, we're still waiting for payments. I've got one scheme we haven't been paid since 2017. Yeah. I've carried on delivering all the goods I contracted to deliver. Mm-hmm. The government haven't delivered the payments. Yeah. Any future scheme cannot do that. I mean, I cannot run a business where any other thing I engage with under a contract, we have a contract arrangement of when I should get paid for the service I deliver. So hopefully it's not going to be straightforward. Mm. I fear they're going to make it overcomplicated if they're not too careful. Mm-hmm. And the words of a new computer system, dread children dread.
Yeah.
Because governments and computer systems do not work.
No.
Or they have
they
not
don't
worked
seem
in the
to
past.
In the UK. No.
No. No, but I do feel it is a better way forward if they can get the delivery right and get the package right and actually put some trust into farmers. Yeah. About, you know, when they come and measure me, when I've had inspections, it's down to 10 centimetres, which is ridiculous to sort of, but you know, I was short in one area by a few square metres. In the field next door, I have 400 square metres. I delivered for free because it fitted the tram lines. But that didn't count.
Right.
So where's this bit about what are you doing on your whole farm? How are you, instead of coming and telling the farmer off, support them.
Yeah.
If I was a food business and you had the food standards agency come in to inspect your premises, they help and guide you. If you're doing it really wrong, they might shut you down. But they'll also give you the information and the support and give you a chance to correct it. The systems we work under, that's it. You get a fine, 5% on everything that possibly could go wrong.
Mm.
And this trust, we need to build that trust back into farmers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as well as someone who's prominent as a farmer, who's doing the huge amounts of positive work for the environment that you are, how much does it frustrate you when you see some of the negative press we get in this regard and some of the sort of high-profile environmentalists use phrases like drowning the countryside in pesticides, things like that? Does that frustrate you? Does it irritate you?
Yeah, when they use blanket terms about all farmers or just the word farming does this,
yeah,
it's like, actually, it is not all farmers. Yes, there are some really poor practices going out there.
Yeah.
I drive around and I see things I wince at. And if I have the opportunity, I'll pass a comment on to sort of say, be careful what you're doing.
Yeah.
But as an industry, we can't defend those poor practices. I mean, we should try and offer support to those farmers and those people that are doing things that actually are really bad and letting the industry down.
Mm.
But the only way I can find working, you know, as much as some, when they say things, I just think, really? So we've got to engage with them. We've got to go and talk to them. We can't just argue with them, particularly through social media, because that's just causes more arguments. But it also shows the public, you know, poor farmers get very excited and others and post things on social media in a way that the farmer thinks is good.
Mm.
But actually, when the public reads it, it is not good. It is actually letting our industry down. But we need to go. I mean, I've welcomed a whole range of conservationists here, and I've met them at other farms, to take them around to explain how and why we're doing it, what is causing us to do some things that they may not like, and whether it's a policy problem or if it's a farmer problem. Well, if it's a farmer, that's fairly easy to change because it's just what we're doing. But if it's a policy thing, don't moan about the farmer and the farming. Let's work together and change the policy side. But yeah, it gets very frustrating. I think, yeah, I'd say I've engaged with many conservationists, and actually when I show them the farm and what we're doing, they get it.
Yeah.
But it's like, just keep the language that you want to support those who are doing, as you're in your eyes, the right thing, and that they're the other part of the industry that you don't agree with is different, and separate them out, because in life there's always good and bad, but when we put them all together, those who are doing the good feel upset and fed up because you're getting pegged in with everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Those who are doing bad, I think, well, it's just the same old people moaning. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
So it is a real challenge. But the only way we can make this work is through conversations and engagement. And that's why I'm very passionate about this engagement through public, through organisations. If I'm sat around a table and talking to someone or got them on a farm somewhere, I can talk about all the things that I don't agree with them about, but we're also talking about the things we can agree about, and yeah, we'll come to some common ground. I won't agree with everything, probably. They won't agree with everything to me, but at least we're working together and we're finding out the problems and we can look for solutions together rather than this reaching for headlines and making stories and then upsetting everybody, because all it does is everyone bunkers down again.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we can achieve so much more if we work together, can't we?
Yeah. Mm. I mean, it is the only way, really, how we fix things as a society, as a country, is finding the things we have got common ground on.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we're slightly different, let's work on those areas, and then we can talk about the other bits and try and make a bigger picture. There are areas, it is a long way apart. But at least we can build some relationships up and, you know, try and understand where we're both coming from and find those solutions.
Yeah. And speaking of conversation and engagement, you are speaking at the Groundswell event the week after next. Are you looking forward to that?
Yeah, really. It's the first year I've made it there. I'd hoped to get last year, but I couldn't. And yeah, really looking forward, particularly engaging with sort of like-minded farmers sort of at home. We've moved away from cultivations to direct drilling cover crops. We've got a drill that's got a crimp roller on, so I'm looking at terminating my cover crops through a crimper rather than through a herbicide. It's not going to be an easy road. But yeah, I think it's an event that has some really very interesting speakers. When you have a look at the list, I don't know how we're going to get round to hear them all.
No.
Luckily, a lot of it's going to be videoed, so we can at least go back and get on the YouTube and learn, hear what they say, because the industry is hugely changing. There's some farmers doing amazing things and really different things, and to bring them together and have really get people talking and do some presentations. And we're doing one as a network. I'm chairing one. There's going to be Friends of the Earth, a network steering group farmer, and another farmer about pesticide reduction and reducing insecticides and pesticides. About how do we work on this? You know, what's the obstacles and how do we reduce our use of these products? Mm. Hopefully that stimulates some good farmer debate and we can look for some solutions of how we go on this journey to use less products.
Yeah, well, I will try and be there. As you say, there's a lot going on, isn't there? So I'm trying to sort of work out where I'm going to be all day, but I will try and come along to that.
Hey, are you just doing the one day?
Yes, I'll be there on the Wednesday. I can't make the Thursday, unfortunately.
We're there on the both days, and I think it's going to be a brain ache kind of couple of days.
I think
it is.
There's
a lot to take in.
Yeah, I think it is. Right, okay. The hour's flown by, so we will end this in the traditional way with five hard-hitting questions, if you're ready. What's your all-time favourite song?
That makes me think, I think it's got to be Come On Eileen, because it's just the memories of young farmers when we're out partying.
Yeah.
That song used to come on and we'd be on the dance floor. And just party hard. And it's just that kind of lively, upbeat song that gets everyone up there dancing.
Yeah, always good at a wedding, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, which historical figure would you most like to be able to go for a pint with?
Yeah, I've been really mulling this one over. And I can't make mind that it would be Henry VIII or Queen Elizabeth I, because they've, in the, both of their lifetime, so much changed.
Yeah.
They led or were involved in so much. But I do think, I mean, Queen Elizabeth, she was there for so long, from so much technology, and just to sort of have a chat with her and sort of see what she thought of it all changing.
Yeah, definitely. That's a really good choice. What's been one of the defining moments in your life? I realise this is a very big question, but I'm quite interested to see where you take it.
Meeting my wife, Juliet, us getting married and having some kids. They are inspiration sometimes. I very often take them for granted because I'm always rushing around, being busy doing everything else.
Yeah.
But that just... to have them here, have their support in most of what I'm doing, is just really special to me.
Yeah, oh, but what's the best book you've ever read?
It's been a very long time since I've read a book, because I do not sit down and read. I if I'm sitting down, I'm doing emails, I'm doing something.
Yeah.
I never find, I just, I'm not one for sitting relaxing. There's just too much to do, so much going on. And sitting still is it's almost dead time. We could be doing something else. There's things to do.
You haven't got into audiobooks then while you're traveling around the country?
That's the one best thing, is it's podcasts like yours and others, to actually, headphones on when I'm sat on a plane, sat on a train. If I'm attracted, that audiobooks, podcasts, you actually learn so much more.
Yeah.
Particularly people from other countries, and just hear about different farming systems and just different, get out of the bubble of farming and listen to everything else that's going on, because we have woes, and you hear so much about mental health problems and loneliness, and that actually we need to just reach out and listen and sort of engage, and that listening to those stories and podcasts, I think, are inspiration of just sort of there are others out there in similar problems that you may be suffering. You're not alone, but do reach out to them.
Yeah, no, I agree. And lastly then, what is your favourite agriculture-related social media account to follow?
I follow a whole range of them because I actually want to see where our arguments to the industry come from and those I support. So, but it also gives us a diverse mix of stuff coming in. So there's Adam Driver, Driver Farms One. He's got some really good stuff. Yep. He's always questioning.
Yes.
Graham Denny, he's been doing some really good stuff about his farm and wildlife. And it's just these people, and another one was Heddy's Farm.
Yeah.
He's been doing some really good videos.
Definitely,
and just sort of about this farmer talking about what works on his farm. It's not about arguing. It's just, this is what I do. This is why. And that sort of makes me stop and think about what I'm doing and what other people can be doing or are doing.
No.
I find them really put those sort of accounts really inspirational about stopping and thinking about where we're going, how are we farming, and what will our future hold.
Yeah, no, really good answers. I enjoy following all of this. It's been brilliant to speak to you. Thank you very much for taking the time, because you are a very busy man, I know. So yeah, and hopefully I'll catch up with you at Groundswell.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing you.
All right. Thanks very much, Martin. And to everyone at home, thanks for listening, and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night. Cambridgeshire to talk to a farmer and chair of the natural... That's a good start, isn't it?
As long as people get it out, it's a too big a name.